Hello everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show on Health Tech. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on wearable EEG in clinical trials now and beyond. This is the 23rd episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show, and today's show is featured on Block Talk Radio. Before we begin with today's introductions, I would like to share the fact that in August, Cure Panel Talk Show is celebrating its first anniversary. We launched the Cure Panel Talk Show in August 2012 with our monthly series on multiple myeloma, and we have grown over the year to conduct talk series on a variety of topics, including prostate cancer, yoga, nanotechnology, and cancer and nutrition. This August, we will be launching our new talk series on breast cancer. Please visit our website, www.trialx.com/curetalk, for information regarding our shows. And you can always mail me, priya@trialx.com, if you would like to be featured on our show. Coming back to today's panel, we are excited to have with us the team from Advanced Brain Monitoring, CEO and co-founder Chris Burka, who has over two decades of brain research and technology development leadership experience, Vice President Manufacturing Jean Davis, who is an expert on international EEG regulatory compliance and ensures technology is viable for clinical studies. Advanced Brain Monitoring specializes in the development of interfaces that can be easily applied by the user without assistance to obtain neuro, cardio, and respiratory signals equivalent to those obtained in a laboratory. The company aims at developing innovative uses of physiology for clinical research, refining them through novel applications, and ultimately manufacturing end-to-user friendly technologies. We also have with us Dr. Ajay Verma. Dr. Verma is currently Global Vice President at Biogen IDEC for Neurology and Experimental Medicine. Dr. Verma is an MD and PhD from the Johns Hopkins University and has trained in neuroscience in the laboratory of Dr. Solomon Snyder. He was also a tenured professor in neurology and neuroscience at the Uniformed Service University of the Health Sciences, the U.S. military's medical school. Next on the panel is Dr. Kamran Falapur, Director of Brain Resource Center. Dr. Falapur is a clinical psychologist. His clinical practice and research activities are focused on health psychology, applied neuroscience, and computer-human interface. Dr. Falapur has years of experience in assessment and treatment of various psychological and neuropsychological conditions that have their roots in the brain, the psyche, and the physiology. I extend a hearty welcome to all the experts. Today's show is co-hosted by Kimberly Blasey. Ms. Blasey is a senior clinical research professional and entrepreneur. She's currently working in business development at Nanotronics Imaging and is writing a science fiction trilogy. Hi, Kim, and welcome to the show. Today, the panel will discuss wearable EEGs in clinical trials now and beyond. The electroencephalogram, EEG, is a classic non-invasive method for measuring a person's brain waves and is used in a large number of fields, from epilepsy and sleep disorder diagnosis to brain-computer interfaces. Electrodes are placed on the scalp and to detect the microvolt-sized signals that result from synchronized neuronal activity within the brain. Wearable EEG is envisioned as the evolution of ambulatory EEG units from the bulky, limited lifetime devices available today to small devices present only on the head that can record EEG for days, weeks, or months at a time. We actually learned about wearable EEGs in a New York Times article that was published on March 27th, which talked about researchers at University of Edinburgh who attached portable EEGs to the scalps of 12 healthy young adults to study the cognitive impacts of green spaces. They asked each volunteer to take a short walk of 1.5 miles that included walking through a park and urban congested areas so that they could detect the brainwave patterns as the walk progressed through different sections. The study found that green spaces lessen brain fatigue, and we thought this would be something useful to discuss as part of our nanotech and innovative health tech cure panel series. We're actually very excited about this technology, and so we invited the executive team from Advanced Brain Monitoring to talk about it. Before I hand over to Kim, I would like to remind all listeners that we will be taking calls, live questions at the end of the discussion. Listeners who have a question for our panel can press 1 on their keypad, and we will bring you live on air to ask your question. Kim, you're live on air.
All right. Thanks so much, Priya, and thanks for bringing me back to host. I really enjoy doing this. And welcome to our panel, and thanks, everybody, for joining us. Before I start in on the questions, I just wanted to say how excited I am specifically to be discussing EEGs, wearable EEGs, not only because they can help monitor our health and our emotional states and give us insights into the brain and our moods and emotions, but they can also help us interact with our environment in terms of reducing the gap between us and technology, which is always something that is fascinating to me. So very excited to be here. My first question I will ask is for Jean Davis. And I first want to discuss a bit about what is EEG and how they are traditionally applied, and then what aspects of wearable EEGs have recently changed.
That's a great question. The standard that many people are used to seeing probably involves something on a TV show where there is a number of leads and cables, and there's a lot of goop that they put in the hair. They have to braid the scalp to get it down to a low impedance, all of this so that they can get a good quality signal to start acquiring it. Also, traditionally, they are not wireless, but in fact wired or plugged into a wall. Some of the more recent changes that you've seen is obviously the wireless aspect of it. And then there are a number of dry technologies as well. In fact, Advanced Brain Monitoring has one under development as well. But probably the biggest changes is the aspect of mobility. With a wireless, with our sensor system, with a higher impedance being acceptable, you can now actually study people in a more natural environment.
Great. And just to probe a bit further here, and again, I'm speaking with Jean, the VP of Manufacturing at Advanced Brain Monitoring. Going off on what you were saying, can you explore a little bit more of how EEGs can tap into our emotional states and measure the emotional states, as Priya was mentioning, the people's and measured by, So can you provide a little insight on how EEGs can help us gain insight into depression or anger or emotions like that?
Certainly, and Chris Burka may jump in as well to add whatever I say, but there's been a lot of recent research in looking at the empathy. There are quite a few publications as well talking about certain aspects of the EEG where they're able to tap into and detect the emotional aspect of the individual. I wouldn't say it's a specific where you could maybe specifically tell that they're angry, it may be frustration, it may be a number of other aspects. But it's certainly something that you're seeing more of in research and publications. Oftentimes we'll also leverage other physiological sensors like ECG, sometimes GSR as well. Those tend to be a little bit lower in the signal quality, so the EEG would be the something that would be more inclined to faster response.
Got it. Okay, great. Thank you very much for that. I'm going to switch over to Chris Burka. Again, Chris is CEO and co-founder of Advanced Brain Monitoring. Chris, I was wondering if you could tell us, of course, about wearable EEGs. When were they first developed? And I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you got started and why you think wearable EEGs is so important.
Sure. Well, first of all, let me just say it's a pleasure to be here, and this is one of my favorite topics, so I really appreciate the opportunity to get this astute panel together. So EEG is probably one of the oldest biomedical technologies in existence. We have, you know, over a century of work backing us up, but it's only recently in the last 20, 30 years with the advent of increased processing capability, miniaturization of electronics, ability to store, produce, and merge and analyze large data sets that we're really starting to see a whole renaissance in the field of EEG analysis and technology. So there's been some many attempts at mobile systems over the last 20 to 30 years, and this is, you know, our area of specialty and expertise. And the goal in designing these systems is to have the least intrusive, unobtrusive systems as possible. We want them to be comfortable and lightweight. And as Gene said, the end goal is to have someone perform their normal daily activities or go to bed at night and sleep and be monitored continuously and not necessarily be aware of that monitoring. So on top of the sensor technology and the electronics, you need to layer in very specific algorithms for identifying potential artifacts. So the EEG, as Priya stated earlier, is a microvolt-sized signal, too small. And what you need to do is be able to identify that you have, in fact, measured EEG and not biological artifacts or environmental contaminants. And so a lot of the work that's been done over the last 30 years has been evolving algorithms that can identify and distinguish EEG from all of those other potential artifacts. Mm-hmm. And then if an artifact is detected, you may need to give the person an alarm to say your sensor fell off, for example. And our systems generally do this by voice messages so that we can make sure that we can continuously collect clean data where the EEGs are derivable.
Okay. And as far as I recall, EEGs still are, I mean, they're not huge. They're maybe half a penny or so size that sit on the scalp at various places and can either be worn as like a cap or they're placed maybe in a few selective places and then wires go back into a wireless kind of transponder that's worn in a pocket or on a belt or something like that. Is that right?
Well, our current systems, both for sleep and for daytime assessment, everything is worn on the head. And
okay.
you may have a sensor array that is anywhere from two or three sensors, which is all we need to stage sleep at night, up to 24 or 32 sensors. That allows us to give a complete neural map. And depending on what your application is, you only may need two or three sensors, or you may need the more extensive net. But what we've been able to do with the microelectronics, and then we have a Bluetooth on board, so we're sending everything wirelessly, is put everything on the head in a very comfortable, comfortably worn system that is 3 ounces, even for the denser array. And then that communicates wirelessly with a smartphone or a tablet or a computer, and you can be 30 feet away because of the wireless communication. So you don't even have to have the receiver on your person. It could be sitting close to you or even in a room located nearby.
Okay, great. Very cool. Thanks for that. And I'd love to kind of keep going on this in this direction of future and how wearable EEGs are changing. And I wanted to target this question to Dr. Verma, who again is the Global Vice President at Biogen IDEC for Neurology and Experimental Medicine. In terms of clinical trials, how are portable or wearable EEGs being used, and how are they also kind of being experimented with and changing to help this whole technology move forward?
Great. Thanks for the question, and thanks for having me on. I think one broad perspective from the standpoint of neurological health is that, you know, we've been struggling to have biomarkers for the healthy brain, and our field has suffered, you know, compared to, let's say, the cardiovascular field, where we have cholesterol and blood pressure and blood sugar and so on. You know, we don't have that brain number, you know, for an individual. And it's kind of a transformative concept, because once you have that number, that biomarker, then it actually changes management. In fact, in many of those diseases, we actually treat the blood pressure number, the blood glucose number, rather than the disease itself, because we know it'll ward off disease. And so we've desperately needed more convenient biomarkers, and we're hoping that by making EEGs, which are a robust biomarker of brain function, you know, more accessible and available to the mobile population at large, this will, you know, create that one of the biomarkers that we need. Imagine if you had to have a catheter every time you measured blood pressure. You know, it wouldn't be a very useful biomarker.
No.
Whereas, you know, going into a CVS store and just getting your blood pressure, you know, measured is terrific. So
This
convenience that the ABM technologies offer, you know, can't be underestimated. And I think if you add to that the comfort, the ease of use, and, you know, without compromising the data quality, you know, it really adds a lot. As far as how this is being used, in clinical practice, EEGs are largely used to study epileptic phenomena or sleep physiology, but in drug development, they are being used in a number of different diseases, neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, ADHD. You may have heard recently there was an EEG device actually approved for treatment in ADHD.
Wow.
But to look at drug responses, you know, the EEG is provides a very robust signal for a variety of drug classes, hypnotics, alerting agents, procognitive agents, and so on. And that's a very key problem that we have early on in clinical development, is how to set our dose. What is the measure that we use to know that we're making an impact on the brain? What I do, you know, the impact of this technology.
Great. That is fascinating. I used to work in cancer clinical research, so of course we would take all the circling biomarkers of the various cancers we worked with to look at their, you know, if they're being, if the drug was efficacious on the cancer or not, or whatnot. So that is fascinating in terms of looking at, you know, brain responses in terms of biomarkers and, you know, in terms of treatment of different drugs and such. So that is fascinating. I also wanted to ask you if you had heard about or know about EEGs that are now worn just through the ear. And so, you know, I'm sure there's only specific kinds of measurements that can be done in the ear, but do you see EEG technology evolving so that it's just going to be one or maybe two electrodes being placed where the algorithms could extract more valuable information? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there are there is an emerging movement of these single lead EEGs. Many of them are actually being used as entertainment devices right now, whereby one can regulate, you know, their one's level of attention or meditation and change their EEG signal. And via Bluetooth, you know, connection, you can actually, for example, move a cursor or something on a computer, or change a color of something. And so there are a number of these gaming technologies. Now, those often use single lead EEGs because that's where the signal is most, you know, robust. If you know ahead of time, you know, where to look, where on the scalp, because the brain does have regional specialization and different parts of the surface of the brain, you know, are involved in different diseases and drug responses. Initially, if you didn't know where to look, you would want to have as complete a set of data as possible. But I could imagine it would be possible that once you know what you're looking at and where to zoom in, you could use one of the other models with less leads or even down to one lead. I'm not as familiar, Chris may be more familiar with the ear thing. I do know, you know, for certain type of epileptic, you know, syndromes, often we need to get an electrode very close to the source of the seizure, let's say. and there are some needle electrodes and so on. But again, this can be customized, you know, based on the problem that one's trying to study and how best to get the data.
Right, I would agree. Yeah. I would agree with AJ on that. I think that there's quite a bit that you can do. For example, full sleep staging, full quantitative objective sleep staging, as I said, with two or three sensors on the forehead, and we have some alertness and drowsiness sleep time algorithms that can also be run with just two sensors on the top of the head, and some of the emotion classifiers and the empathy metrics that have been examined that we've been looking at also require just a handful of sensors, which you need to know exactly where to put them. And so for some of these more complex disorders where you're looking at depression or neurological disease, trying to distinguish between some of the subtypes of dementias, there we need the more complete map first before we can down select to the number of sensors and where to put those sensors.
Right. Okay, great. Yeah, thanks for weighing in there, Chris.
It's kind of like an EKG. You know, when you want to know you can get a full EKG to look at all your conduction issues in your heart tissue, or if you just want to get a simple rhythm strip, you just need one lead. You know, so it depends on what you're looking for.
I see. Yeah, that's very clarifying. I want to return to this topic. It's particularly exciting to me, but I want to bring in Dr. Falapour. And again, Dr. Falapour is clinical psychologist and director of the Brain Resource Center in New York. Kamran and I actually had the pleasure of working together on a project about a year or so ago, so I'm actually friends with Kamran and very happy to be speaking to him again. It's been a little while for us. Kamran, welcome to the show. I just wanted to kind of ask you just to kind of pipe in here on this and ask, I know you use EEG technology all the time in your work and would love to hear how you use it and how you think this innovation can help evolve just our health, our knowledge about our emotions and brain health in general.
Well, thank you, Kimberly. First of all, thanks for the invitation. It's great to have you as a moderator. It's been a while since I've seen you, so it's good to hear your voice.
Likewise.
Thank you. So, you know, we have been involved with EEG and physiological monitoring on multiple levels. We use it in biomarker studies where we have looked at basically biomarkers, looking at depression population, testing various antidepressants and basically drug response. Same with ADHD. We have also been involved with, some years ago actually, we developed some Bluetooth device for monitoring EEG remotely, which we've used in both clinical setting and some research setting. But I've also been privileged to be in a field where I can actually apply these to patients today and see how we can utilize the research in neuroscience and kind of use it not only for monitoring what goes on, but also to give real-time feedback so patients can actually change their state in real time as they go through a task. So with that, in a number of clinical situations, we have used also EEG. And I think that the advancements with, you know, the portable EEG units and other physiological measures is really opening a new door both for research and also for human brain interface, clinical applications, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very exciting. There are a number of challenges that, of course, are involved, which I'm glad both, I think Chris alluded to them, and I think other panelists also mentioned about, you know, teasing out what's really a clear signal, what's movement artifact, what's muscular artifact, which, you know, when you go to faster activities, it's very difficult to detect, and what is eye movement artifact, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we're getting better and better at those. Devices are getting smaller, more comfortable to use. We've tested a number of devices. I happen to have been involved in developing some devices that do remote monitoring, but also kind of consulted various companies on such development. So I've seen a development of these devices becoming more robust and becoming more user-friendly, and I think the future of both research and clinical use is quite exciting.
Great. Great. And I would love for you to describe, too, how, you know, because this is kind of a two-way street, what the kind of research you work with and the kind of way that you work with patients. It's not just monitoring. You monitor, but then you take that information and allow the patient to participate in the data that you receive from the EEG monitoring to,
yes,
you know, and this is where I want you to pipe in, either change brain chemistry or connection so that they experience less depression or less stress. I'd love for you to share a little bit about how that works.
Yeah, sure. So we've done lots of brain mapping using EEG and quantitative EEG, and there are certain profiles that are associated with certain disorders. For instance, not all, but most kids and adults with ADHD happen to have increased slow activity, mostly in the theta range, in the frontal lobe. And once that's identified, and the exact out, we can design paradigms where in real time we can measure activities with just a single or double channel EEG and actually teach children by way of giving them feedback and reinforcements, teaching them how to inhibit the increased amplitude or power of those waves, that brain activity, which is really neuronal firing in synchrony in real time, and to sort of bring their behavior, which in this case is the neuronal activity and the behavior of the brain, closer to the norm in real time. And what we observe is this model of kind of self-regulation through monitoring and rewarding brain activity seems to work pretty well for a number of disorders. And it's also very exciting because not only the data is available for research and seeing how people go through various stages of that, but also in terms of making actual changes in real time that once it's reinforced over and over again becomes somewhat a repertoire of the activity of that person's brain, and they sort of learn how to operate on that level.
I think that's very cool. I wanted to just briefly open this up to either Chris or Dr. Verma or Jean to comment on if the advanced brain monitoring group will be working in a similar way, or you know, has any ideas or thoughts about the two-way street using the EEG data to help patients heal.
Sure. We've done a number of devices on our own. One of them is called the Adaptive Peak Performance Trainer, where we characterize an expert state in marksmanship, golf, and other athletic performance, including archery. And then we provided feedback to novices or intermediates and trained them to produce the expert brain state before they picked up the rifle or the bow and arrow or the golf club, and accelerated skill training by training them first to produce the state of an expert. Accelerated skill training by a factor of 200%. So,
wow.
You know, these systems, in addition to, you know, helping overcome diseases, can also help accelerate normal performance in some of these, you know, simple skill domains. And then we've partnered up with Dr. Bob Thatcher on a fairly large neurofeedback project. He's developed his software over the last 30 years. And has a normative database, a fairly substantial normative database, and that uses the 20 channels to characterize a normative brain state and then allow you to load up the normative characteristics and then move an abnormal brain closer to the normative state through a variety of feedback tools. So we're keenly interested in this area of neurofeedback training.
Oh, great. great to hear. And Dr. Verma, any comment from Biogen, you know, moving toward this kind of information exchange here regarding EEGs?
Well, I think the you know, again, making these robust devices, you know, available to the mobile masses are going to lead to new uses, you know, that we probably didn't expect before. EEGs can be very useful assistive devices for people that are handicapped, for example. You know, if they can learn to control their brain. I've seen a wheelchair, for example, whereby, you know, if you sort of concentrate or meditate, you move forward or backwards. If you blink your left eye or right eye, you can turn left or right. There are ways to, you know, read random letters on a screen, and once you see the letter you want, a certain evoke potential is triggered, so thereby you can just type, you know, just by looking at certain letters on a screen and using the EEG response to that.
Yeah.
So I think it's really up to the creative inventors now how to use it. And previously with the bulky devices, obviously that was very limiting. But now that the convenience of these devices may open up a whole field of new uses for EEG.
Yeah, great. That's very, very exciting. This is something I personally kind of get very passionate about, this, where especially paralyzed people with locked-in conditions can begin to simply think and start to communicate and exchange information, you know, turn on the lights of their house, their wheelchair, move around. Like you're saying, that's something I, anyways, I'm very, very excited about that. I wanted to talk a little bit now about kind of the math and the algorithms behind all this, which are just as important as the technology itself. And I kind of wanted to just ask each of our panelists, or at least go through the different kind of companies that are representative here. So, Dr. Verma, I'll start with you since we're talking already. What do you find in terms of the algorithms and how they're developed? Do you need to hire, you know, specialist IT people who know about brain waves and things like that, or can you hire any IT person to do this? How critical is it to really have a good IT team to develop and figure out these algorithms?
Well, it's the art of extracting meaningful signals, you know, from EEG is really an art, and it takes a lot of insight and skills, and you do have to know a lot about signal analysis, noise, how to clean up the signals, you know, what is noise, what is not.
Yeah.
You also have to know some neurobiology, whether something makes sense. So it's sort of a multidisciplinary cultivated art, in my opinion, and it's not trivial to do. Maybe for simple things, you know, like an attention or a meditative state or sleep, you know, it's possible. But there's such a rich amount of data to be had in what's happening in cortical activity that we have not found it easy. And I've used EEG at several other companies that I've worked at. And, you know, it does take a certain rigor of having the hardware just right, you know, the controls just right, the noise, you know, low, being able to extract the features and weed out the noise. A lot of the stuff that happens under the hood is the most important stuff. And the sensors and electronics have definitely advanced, but I think Chris remarked on this earlier, the analysis is where I think that the biggest gains are to be made. You know, and there are various ways to look at it. There's many, many different ways to look at EEG signals, and there may even be more ways that are going to be invented soon, especially as we try to couple EEG activity to functional imaging activity, for example, on MRI and so on, to make better sense of what the EEG signals mean. But I think Chris is sort of the expert on the analysis here, so maybe I'll let her comment further on that.
Well, I'm supported by a pretty sophisticated team of PhD-level engineers here at Advanced Brain Monitoring. So we have electrical engineers, biomedical engineers. We have several experts just in signal processing and signal detection algorithm development. And then we have neuroscientists and several psychophysiologists, psychologists, clinical psychologists. So we have a pretty good range of expertise, starting at the engineering level and working up to the you know, human clinical trials and neuroscience level. And it takes that team really to kind of study the problem at all of all the different levels and develop, you know, algorithms and then also develop ways to deal with artifacts. So, you know, you're always going to have some signals that you're recording that are larger than the EEG signal. So what do you do with those? In many cases, there's EEG, qualified EEG, right? On top of that, you want to layer in the connections between all of the different channels of the brain and you know, do your mapping so that it maps to the neuroscience and the neuropsychology that we understand the different regions of the brain. And then on top of that, we've done a lot of work with large databases. So now, you know, first of all, you want a normative database that you can map against, and that database has to be perfectly clean and validated, and you want to make sure that you have reproducible results so that you can take an EEG on someone day one, day two, day three, and make sure that, you know, there's some consistency across the measures that you're looking at to replicate. A lot of what we've been doing is looking at ways to, even in group situations, so whether it's a small team interacting or a one-on-one situation where you have a dyad, can you now look at some of these metrics at a more meta level and say, you know, how are two people communicating by looking at the brain, the neurometrics in real time? And those kind of data sets are large and challenging. You know, often we're bringing in nonlinear mathematics and do a lot of work with neural nets and Markov modeling and very sophisticated mathematics, always with an eye towards, can we run this in the real-time environment? So it's a big data problem and challenge, but it's a great challenge to have.
Definitely. Very complex and large amount of data that needs to be parsed out, and some need to be sorted as noise, some need to be sorted as a repeatable, reliable signal and indicator of things. Kamran, I want to ask you about this as well. Whenever I visited you in your offices in New York, I see mainly clinical staff, nurses and coordinators and things like that. Do you also have a whole math lab where you have people kind of analyzing this data, breaking it down, or do you rely on kind of tried and true algorithms? How do you handle this great data problem here?
Yeah, I think most panelists really alluded to this, but I'll repeat again. You know, from our side, we had a team of physicists, neuroscientists, mathematicians, statisticians, and neurologists and neuropsychologists who all contributed to basically developing algorithms to make sure that the artifacting and other aspects of the database, basically the algorithms that go into it, are robust. And of course, these databases, and you know, I was involved, there was a team of kind of international consortium of neuroscientists involved in developing what I believe may be now the largest database of not only EEG, but also ERPs, which are, you know, event-related potentials, a number of activation tasks, and also neurocognitive data, tests such as tests of attention, memory, auditory, visual, so a whole neuropsychological battery as well, as some genetic data, and also a number of dozens of questionnaires and scales that are normally used in research, all into one database, where then this database had to be, of course, validated and standardized. I believe, again, Chris alluded to this, that there is this just not something you put together and say it's done.
Yeah.
It has to go through all kinds of validation and standardization. And then once that's done, then you can compare patient populations to it and so forth. Then it becomes a very powerful tool, not only for looking at individual data sets, but also groups of people and also looking at drug responses And obviously now, you know, the pharma companies have been interested. We've run a couple of trials already using not only EEG, but a number of other physiological measures and also neuropsych data in the biomarker area, which is quite exciting.
Great. Yeah, there's I actually personally didn't know that there was a kind of a collective database that was regulated and standardized that had a lot of answers to these kind of signal-to-noise ratios and what's a clean signal versus not. What oversight bodies or what kind of regulatory bodies help to monitor that?
Well, there are a number of ways. One is that validation and standardization needs to be done through, you know, you need to publish in scientific journals and have, again, as was recommended before, it's not just one study. There needs to be a number of studies showing that, showing validation, standardization, repeated EEGs on different days, showing that the normative database, the features and all the elements are actually standardized. And then there are, depending on which country basically this is going to be used in, there is, you know, FDA regulations, there is other scientific and regulatory bodies that look into this. But I'm sure that the other panelists have other opinions or aspects of this they want to discuss.
Yeah, I'd love to bring Gene Davis on, again, who's the VP of Manufacturing at Advanced Brain Monitoring, who has expertise in international EEG regulatory compliance. I'd love to hear your thoughts on kind of the regulatory oversight bodies, what kind of, how standards are arrived at, if, you know, if they have to pass a certain kind of governing body. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. The from a medical perspective, well, each country has its own specific aspects that they may focus on. Just by way of example, for medical devices, it all falls under ISO 60601-1, which is just a broad standard medical regulation. And that is an international group that comes together to decide on what those specific requirements are. And it covers everything from safety for both the patient and the technician possibly using it, as well as noise radiated by the device, as well as how robust the device has to be in a normal environment. For EEG, there's a specific substandard or particular standard, they call it, which is actually 60601-2-26. That covers specific aspects of EEG itself. And while there is a standard that's the international standard, there's then the European Union derivatives of that. There's U.S. derivatives. There are Canadian derivatives. More or less every country has may have their own specific unique to that country or unique to a specific aspect of what their infrastructure might already be.
Got it. Okay, great. Thanks very much for that. I personally am interested in their regulatory bodies and the oversight bodies, and it just helps to standardize and kind of confirm validity and the reliability of these tests. So that is critical.
So they have the standard, but it's also a requirement for you to then go through a certified testing body. So it's not just as if someone can say, hey, our device meets these standards because we say so. You generally have to go through a certified testing body to get that taken care of. In America, you go through FDA for medical. For Europe, there's also an additional standard or subgroup that also comes in and audits our facility as well. Make sure we're following our...
Kind of on the flip side of this, what has been, you know, and I'd love to hear from everybody on this, what has been the major difficulties or road bumps you've come up with in terms of using wearable EEGs, you know, not only in the algorithms, but just in people complying. I'd love to hear just some of the hurdles you have faced in extracting, you know, reliable data from wearable EEGs. And Gene, if you want to comment, we can start with you and then go around the panel.
Certainly. You know, depending on the study you're doing, there's a wide scope of issues to overcome, sometimes depending on the environment, sometimes depending on patient acceptance. You know, what I've really found to be the one of the bigger hurdles is even disbelief on the current medical community, where they've been using the old collodion and tape and, you know, getting abrading the skin to get the impedances down, that there's a bit of disbelief that this technology is even something that is wearable in today's world. Many of them, I think, still think it's something that's science fiction. So I still am surprised even to this day on some of the pushback we get on the new technologies from the entrenched experts, if you would.
Right. Chris, do you want to add anything to that in terms of challenges or difficulties?
Sure. One of the things that we deal with every day, we're generally running anywhere from 500 to 1,000 human subject studies here every year, and one of the first things that comes up is privacy concerns and also sort of the added concern of not just the health privacy issues, which of course we have to be HIPAA compliant and make sure that we protect and treat all people's data with the utmost privacy and protection, but also the concern that we're trying to read people's minds. That is a very common someone coming in for the first time, you know, thinks that we're putting these sensors on their head and we're going to be able to tell, you know, what they're thinking or what they did last night. And, of course, that's not the case. But it is something that, you know, privacy issues are important for both the health concerns as well as just overcoming the initial response of, you know, you're reading my mind. And that's, of course, not what we're doing. But it is important to overcome any of those concerns and fears.
Sure. Dr. Verma, I'd love to hear from you. Any, let's say aside from these perceived challenges from either potential users or critics, what are some practical roadblocks or road bumps you've come up with in regard to wearable EEGs?
You know, most of my experience has been with using it in clinical trials, and those are very controlled settings. So we can force people to wear them and then adjust them. It's really the
as
analysis.
Long as they find consent, that is.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I think it's just the analysis and the robustness of the data, and that's been a challenge in some studies. You know, some of the EEG systems in the past have been susceptible to noise, you know, from other electronics on the floor, for example. I think the newer technologies have really made it a lot easier. I have some of these mobile, you know, single lead headsets that are more sort of entertainment, and my eight-year-old daughter actually wears them and plays games on the computer with them. So I think that shows you how acceptable it's coming from being this cumbersome,
sure,
you know, spool of wires in the past. But for me, it's really been about the quality of the data and the reliability and the repeatability. That's been a challenge, and to find a good system and laboratory that you know, assures good quality of data is paramount for us.
Yeah, definitely. Great. And then just finally, Dr. Falapur, not only are you dealing with just monitoring, you're dealing with people responding, getting remonitored, responding. What have been some of the challenges you faced in the research you do?
Sure, I'll be happy to talk about that. But generally, I think EEG is a fantastic signal, but it's a very fragile signal. There are a number of ways that it can be affected, some of which sometimes we may not pay attention to, even the type of lighting you have or sources of electronic devices. I think Gene just mentioned that, or what equipment you have around you. All of those things can really impact it. So in my experience, mostly with wet electrodes, meaning using gel or paste, One of the ways we are able to really secure a good signal with low impedance is to use gel or paste, and not everyone likes that. It's a very messy process in a way. So, you know, people don't like doing it, although we try to really make it, you know, minimal, and we have developed methods to make it easier. I have tried a number of other more dry options, dry electrodes. Personally, I have not liked any of them. I'm actually eager to try some of the dry electrodes that I think have been developed. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, some of the panelists have been involved with developing. I'm very curious and looking forward to trying those. So I think from an end-user point of view, I think the comfort, because, you know, when you go to gaming or things like that, it's easy because the accuracy of data may not be that important. Mm-hmm. But when you're in a clinical situation or research situation, the signal and basically the quality of the signal is everything. As the engineers say, it's garbage in, garbage out. If the signal you're getting in is contaminated, the basically interpretation you have also is not really good. Therefore, in order to get good signal, often we have to go through these messy processes. And and some of the patient subjects are not very compliant with it, especially if they have to do it several times or many times. But I'm looking forward to the future of dry electrodes and other ways of actually getting the data that can be both accurate and very comfortable.
Great. Well, I want to be respectful of our time. Priya, did you want to open up the line to listeners? I have one more question I can ask everybody. If not, you let me know what's best.
You can ask your question, Kim, and then we can proceed.
Okay, great. So this is my favorite question. I'm happy I get to ask it. I wanted to hear from everyone in terms of, or in regards to the future of wearable EEGs. And, you know, of course, this can help us, as Dr. Verma was saying, in terms of this is another biomarker. This is allowing us to hear biological-based feedback about our health in response to drugs or situations or environments. But beyond, you know, it doesn't have to be beyond health, either within the health realm or beyond. Where do each of the panelists feel or get excited about the future of wearable EEGs in terms of technology or the paralyzed being able to drive cars or whatever it is? I'd love to hear from each of you what you feel the potential is here. So I'll start with Chris. Would love to hear your thoughts on this.
Sure. Well, I think everything is going to get smaller and smarter and faster. So the sensor technology that we're using today is already 5 years larger, you know, out of date in comparison to consumer electronics. So we can count on material science, and whether it's nanotechnology or other material science, allowing us to access these signals easier and with still with high quality in smaller and smaller devices. What's exciting to me is that, you know, I really envision a very near-term future where, AJ that pointed this out, where it becomes part of the standard physical, and more we may see a standard physical being done at home or, you know, not necessarily having to go anywhere to get a physical done. And a standard, and the EEG will just become part of that. So you'll be tracking your brain from the time that you have your first checkup, maybe at birth, until you die. And so we'll have, you know, longitudinal data on the brain as it develops that we can then map to some of these databases that are now growing, which will allow us earlier and earlier detection of things that, you know, early stages of dementia. And as we all know, you know, one of the most devastating diseases of our time, and there are many treatments coming out, hopefully sooner rather than later, but we need to be able to assess and diagnose these diseases much earlier so that the treatments can be made available and then assess treatment outcomes. But I think all of these things you'll see fairly soon. This is not a far off distant future.
Just like to add to that, this is AJ Verma. When you collect an EEG on an individual under controlled settings, if you do that over and over again under the same settings, you actually find that the EEG is actually like a biometric signature of that person. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's been studies done where your children will have, some similarities. In fact, twin studies, show some resting EEG similarities between the individuals. Mm-hmm. So it's much like a fingerprint or an iris scan. It could be considered a biometric of the way your brain, runs under certain states. Mm-hmm. And if one can map that to echo what Chris is saying during a healthy baseline, you might find that this instrument is exquisitely sensitive to deterioration from, from health. So it could be an early warning system, potentially, that, you need to go get some help or something like that. And I'm hoping it can rise to the level of that type of biomarker for the, wider masses. And
yeah,
not just be used when you actually have the illness, but hopefully use it to identify early signs of illness and ward them off.
That's great. And that would be such a non-invasive, even like Chris, you were saying, do-it-yourself at home type of way that patients could take their own kind of baseline and see where they're at and send it to their healthcare provider. So I think that's a great idea. Jean, did you want to add anything to this?
Yeah, I think I'm kind of excited about the consumer aspect of it. I think there's not a significant there's a large amount of funding, I should say, towards those that are true patients and will benefit most from this. But I think that when you get it into the masses, that you'll start to get more people involved, more funds will come in when there's money for other companies to chase after. That I think in the end will benefit those that truly need it. While at the same time giving a better quality of life to a normative or healthy patients, as well as the biomarker aspect of it.
Great. And Kamran, I'd love to hear your thoughts about the future.
Sure.
Where you'd like to get technology go?
Sure. A lot of what I had in mind was already discussed. But let me just say that we've done repeated quantitative EEGs on a range of populations, including people who are in peak performance mode to the end of the spectrum with, patients in vegetative states.
Mm-hmm.
And the repeated EEGs show very solid results that this is actually a biomarker, as was discussed before. And we've already done my biomarker studies basically focused on EEG and ERPs. So I think the time for that has already come. We already have patients who do this routinely once a year just to make sure that, we have a baseline, but we are also monitoring improvements, et cetera. And I agree that this will be one of the measures in the future that will be part of your yearly physical and hopefully would be easier and easier to use and would be more readily available for the masses. Yeah.
Great. Really, really great. Well, thanks very much, and I really enjoyed co-hosting. I'm actually going to turn the meeting, I guess, podcast over to Priya, who is going to take it from here.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you very much. That was really a great discussion. We have received a lot of questions, a couple of questions from our participants. I would quickly go over them. The first one is, do you see wearable EEGs make a breakthrough in mind-body research and provide solid evidence for effects of spiritual practices? Dr. Falapur.
Well, I think that's a difficult question because we need to kind of define almost every word in that question. but I do believe that human beings have a very wide range of experience, and those states are certainly a part of that. And there's already a body of research going on using EEG, looking at meditative states and how meditation, correlates to meditative states and EEG and various states of consciousness that we've been able to clearly show. And I think we can continue to look at that, and we also know the impact of these sort of practices, mindfulness or being in a state where you're totally relaxed, you know, alpha, theta states that traditionally has been called, and the relationship to your health and a relationship to various kind of states of consciousness, that we have a lot of reports from, you know, people who enter into these states who talk about how they feel their bodies in a state of healing, or there is the mind-body paradigm that, you know, is being discussed in some of the research. And I think there is a lot to explore there. And it's an exciting area.
Thank you, Dr. Falapur. Chris, I think you can take the next one. Does the EEG only record surface brain signals, or can it pick up signals from structures that are buried in the brain, such as the limbic system that regulate emotional responses? Are there signature patterns for each emotional status?
That is an excellent set of questions. And so if you have a fairly large array of sensors placed on the surface of the scalp, you can at least get some indication of what is going on in some of the deeper structures of the brain. But we are primarily looking at cortical activity when we're recording from the surface. There are some reflections of what's going on in the deeper structure. And this is an area of some controversy as to how closely and how many sensors you need and what type of mathematics you need to model some of the deeper structures. And as far as mapping emotional states, I think this is still we're still very early in the exercise. Particularly for normative populations. We've been working on this problem ourselves for almost 10 years. And because there's so much variation across individuals with regard to emotions, I mean, there are some broad emotional states that everyone agrees on kind of the ground truth. But I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done for mapping emotional states using surface EEG.
Thank you, Chris. The next question is, can we annotate what we are doing in wearable EEGs to better correlate brain signals with our activities? Dr. Verma?
Yeah, I think so. Well, first of all, the clearest example of that is probably sleep. There are very characteristic changes in the EEG pattern with that activity. However, I assume the caller's asking about wake activity, and that's where I think some of these cutting-edge experiments that were mentioned about performance, you know, during a sporting event, during a task, and how the EEG signal is, reporting whether you're in optimal performance or not. That's a whole new area that I think is going to be very exciting to watch. And much like biofeedback, it may actually be a form of feedback for enhancing one's own performance.
Thank you, Dr. Verma. I think we are almost over time now. That was a wonderful discussion. I thank the panel for being with us today. Thank you all for your support, and we look forward to having all of you join us for the next Your Panel Talk Show on August 8th to be inspired by young adult cancer survivor stories. For more details of our upcoming shows, please visit trilex.com/curetalk. The link for today's show will be sent via email to all participants. Thank you.